raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens. Bright copper.
Good evening, dear listeners.
Brown paper packages tied up with string.
This is Symposium.
These are a few of my favorite things.
Tonight, our special issue is devoted to Mark Akatansky's My Favorite Things, an investigation on John Coltrane's parametric thinking.
On their wings. These are a few of my favorite things. Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes, snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes, silver white winters that melt into springs. These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad.
I guess you know these tunes. This tune. A tune is not a song, but a constellation of notes that can be moved, transfigured, and circulated in multiple ways, perhaps infinitely.
In Stuttgart.
Yeah.
So you were invited to do this in Stuttgart, and the person who invited you, he knew about this. He didn't have the budget to do something in space, so he invited you to do a sound piece or some sound work. But he knew about this.
Yeah.
So before all this even started,
and as we were communicating, I let on at one point this obsession I had with my favorite things. That I'd been at that time, and it was not so easy in some of the early days of the internet to track down, you know, auctions and record stores in Japan and Brussels and all these bootlegs of the various many times that Coltrane played this tune live, because he recorded it in 60 and played it up until his death in 67. And so I was hunting down all of these and trying to imagine what kind of transformation. That I'm using to investigate Renaissance artists and architects and 18th century artists and architects and 20th century. For me, these transformative modes is the basis of all the kind of design work I do and all the writing I do. And so Coltrane was a perfect As I write in the essay, it seems like to me the first hip-hopper, the first one to sample and scratch develop these transformative techniques, which today would in architecture would be called parametric. Yeah, well, I was obsessed enough to try to track down several dozen records all over the world of this one song. You know, the way I think of it is that if you want to sharpen a knife, you should sharpen it against a hard stone. So you find works in the world that are not just moving to you, but are a puzzle to you, and if they're poignant and pointed, then you have to figure out. I mean, if you're an artist, you try to figure out the technique that's involved. And figuring out the technique doesn't take away the mystery of it. It actually increases the drama and the mystery of it, even though you know it's pure technique. And so I at one point, years before, someone knew a jazz musician. I brought them in, and we played this, and I would stop it every other second and say, okay, what's he doing now? And, you know, typical to a lot of artists, all they could say, well, he's really grooving now, or he's really jamming. And that was no use to me. And then he switched over into musical terminology, and because I don't know that, that also became opaque. That was as opaque when he said he's going up three octaves and he's doing, you know, he's on F sharp now or whatever he was saying. That also was useless to me. And so I wanted to try to find a way that I could really track operations. And to me, the play, and it's a play that's in my own work, is you could call it between figuration and abstraction. You can call it between semantics and syntax. Understanding that syntax is semantic, where you put the order of words is an operation of meaning. It's not just a formal operation. The questions of figuration and abstraction, questions of semantics and syntax, were all being played in the postmodern period in architecture, usually on separate camps. And I never understand those kinds of camps. It doesn't, you know, the fact that John Coltrane is playing a Broadway tune should be almost a parody or a kind of transgressive act against this sappy, sentimental, silly song. But as he says, it's an incredible tune. He recognized the deepness of what Rodgers and Hammerstein had done. And then it turns out, in fact, you know, he says it's like the gospel, it's like the blues. It is. This song was written as Hammerstein was dying of cancer. And the song says, and they don't feel so bad. So already there's a kind of a melancholic condition in the song. It's much more complex. And as Coltrane says, it meant that you can tease out more and more layers that are in this song because they're already in the song. The entanglements are in the object. And I was trying to develop an architecture and graphics and installations where the entanglements were enacted in the object, performed in the object. So that's why Coltrane was really important to me. And bringing this musician, it made it clear that no one was going to be able to tell me this. I had to get into the piece itself. Yeah, I think I have these dates correct, that the show was on Broadway from 59 to 61. Coltrane, it must have been such a big hit because Coltrane recorded this in 60. And the movie came out in 65. I mean, when the dog bites, when the bee stings. Mm-hmm. When I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad. And again, you can imagine if someone is dying of cancer, you know, what that catalog would be about. And that's why Coltrane talks about it as a gospel blues. The interplay that he finds there, the entanglements that are already within the original object, that's what's so interesting, is that he finds it there and he keeps obsessing over it from 60 to 67. And that, I mean, and in other words, we're way past the moment, I mean, where he's playing it all the way to the very last concert. And by that point, he's in, you know, what was sloppily called free jazz and et cetera. He's way out there. And the piece gets super attenuated, and you know, the 60 minutes for the Live in Japan one, it gets way, 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 way attenuated by the end. So he shouldn't even be playing, he doesn't need to play Broadway tunes by that point, because he's trying to be part of a kind of avant-garde and not part of the original, just general swing thing that he starts with. By that point, he could have jettisoned that long ago. Certainly by 64, certainly by 65, he should have jettisoned that. But he can't, and he keeps trying to mine more. So his obsession with that, and his obsession with how he could keep transforming it, or rather find transformations that are already entangled within that, that he would tease out more and more. And that's what, you know, by the end, when it sounds like he's really abstracting it and barely back on the melody over here, what I want to say is what he's doing are these little micro-melodic moments, and they're just happening at a shorter interval, so it seems to be that free jazz moment over there, but it's still balancing between certain figurations, certain abstractions, certain lyricisms. It's not totally lost the lyrical quality at the end. It just is now chopped up into finer and finer little bits. Mm.
And so, back to 2002, you are in this type of elaboration of your interest, your obsession for Coltrane. You get this invitation. You end up accepting to do a sound piece. You feel that this is what you want to do. And so, what is the exact process that brings you to this sequence of tracks? It's a strange progression, almost like in a jazzistic process, where you start humming the tune, the original tune, and then you start making variations and you start playing around, and then you end up finding the real like structure and manipulating the guts of the track. How is this process, and what brings you from one tune to the other? Maybe we can listen to the first one. The anticipation.
The original one, or the
no, the anticipation. Yeah.
Okay.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things. Cream colored ponies and crisp apple strudels, doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles, wild geese that fly with the moon on their wings. These are a few of my favorite things. Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes, snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes, silver white winters that melt into springs. These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember.
So already, right from the beginning, part of performative modes for me is that there is no such thing as character. There is no real singularity. Characters are already multiple, and their multiplicity gets drawn out in response to other characters from scene to scene. And so that's why the duet is really intriguing. You know, it's what I call the good buddy system, you know, like in Big Lebowski.
So in the original score, you have Mary Martin singing her part, then Mother Abbess sings, and it finishes with a duet.
And then it's not even a duet, it's an alter. It alters.
It's an alteration.
Yeah, it's an alteration in the original. And so then when we overlaid it, so it really was a duet all the way through, they begin to influence each other. We made it so that in order for them to be singing in sync, we had to slow down or speed up, or the way I like to say it is, you know, slow up and speed down, so that they had to push and pull each other. And that's the interesting moment. And that's true of the orchestra, too. And that's, for me, is the fun moments where you suddenly begins to happen over there. Or the plink plink is just slightly off.
Yeah.
So that was the first test. That was just a real quick test drive of trying to see what would happen when you would create these interactions that were otherwise kept apart. For example,
red drops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright purple petals and warm woolen mittens, brown table.
They seem fine. They seem fine here. You know, it's all going along smoothly.
Right up the springs, these are a few of my favorite things.
Right there, you can see that the orchestra is not quite.
Green collar ponies and crisp apple strudels, your bells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles, wild geese that fly with the moon on their wings. These are.
You mean the orchestra, because the duet is also the duet of the two orchestras, the two.
There's only one orchestra, but because we.
Yeah, exactly. The one orchestra in two different times.
Exactly. Overlapping. Yeah, they're not in sync. They're not part. I mean, for whatever reason, they weren't exact.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, today they would, in the sound, you'd get rid of all of those eras, which is always the problem of getting rid of it and making it seem much more mechanical.
Mm.
But back then, they let it play. And they didn't correct that, and they didn't see that there would be no reason to correct it. They were just following along. But when you actually lay them over each other, they're off of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Right there. Girls in white dresses.
With blue satin sashes, snowflakes to stay on my nose and eyelashes, silver white winters that melt into springs. These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I go feel so bad.
So. You have the original track, and you know exactly what you're going to do when you start working on this with Fareed. You know perfectly well that you want to go through these steps, or does this sequence of this this track that you call duet anticipation, then the next one, the duel.
No, MC.
And then the dual duet. So how does the sequence form, starting with the original? I mean, assuming that the original is actually for you, Coltrane, and then you go to the source, and then you start working on the source, and.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the main thing was to do MC. And I thought that I would have like an album's worth of different variations of that. And there were a number of other thoughts I had about what those would be But just as a warm-up exercise, we just took that first one. And that's not different from either when I'm doing an architectural design or whether I'm doing research on Giulio Romano. It's what's the original material and trying to break it down and see the steps that are already in there before I start doing the transformations.
John Coltrane, McCoy Tyner, Jimmy Garrison, Roy Haynes.
Should I tell them to come at 7? Is that better?
No, don't worry about that.
Okay, great.
But we're still recording here.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Now, the central piece of Mark Rakatansky's My Favorite Things. It's a central piece for many reasons, but could you introduce us a little bit to the making and to the actual centralness of, yeah. of this one.
Yeah. This was always a central piece because in my obsession with trying to find all the various bootlegs at the time when I did the piece, there was 28, now there's 35 and 36 coming out next month. Not bootlegs, now they're official, but anyway. So it was listening to the differences in each of them over the period of time from 60 to all the way to when it was by 66, he was doing an hour version, and then 67, it cut down a little bit, but quite extreme differences. But my favorite one was Newport 63, because it has that balance of tension between the original, somewhat tame, it was never tame, but to where it gets really atomized by the end. So for years I was trying to track those operations, and I could never get anyone or any of the articles that I would read about it never really made it clear to me, either because it was too metaphoric, the analysis, or it was too precise to musical terminology, which is its own lingo. And it really didn't, wasn't informative as a series of techniques and operations. So it was a nut that needed cracking for me. It was a thing that I needed to hunt down. And the technique that I seemed to me most relevant, or maybe relevant's not the word over here, but most pointed, was to go through its poignancy around the lyricalness of it. That's the operation of sample and scratch that I believe Coltrane is doing. And so that's why I tried to use Mary as the secret lens by which to decode, reveal the I think it was important to show that it wasn't somehow a juxtaposition of a Broadway show tune with the beginnings of a certain kind of avant-garde free jazz. That this was not just a binary object that just happened to be joined together here. That it was really through and through an anamorphic condition. And the anamorphic condition is that the abstract operations are beginning to abstract the lyrical, and the lyrical is beginning to morph the abstract. And so in order to do that, it was crucial to have Mary sing along with John. To show how fully entangled the lyrical was in his work. And there are various quotes from this time where he takes a poem he writes, and this is a little bit later in 64, he takes a poem he writes and then tries to make a musical development. And he talks about why the lyrical and why architecture is important ways for him to see things. And the most interesting architecture to me, and the most interesting paintings and writings and music, you can see or hear the transformations. So the dynamicness is in the transformations, not just in the time, but in the time. track that development, to see the way in which Mary was engaged, we had to then take Mary apart. And it was just, it's a, you know, each one of these sections just took weeks and weeks to do, because we had to splice Mary into about 1,500 pieces and hand sand, so to speak, and hand construct the way in which she would put the emphasis on the right and wrong syllable, and the pitch and time would begin to match Coltrane in some, in very extreme ways, as you'll hear in the final cut, duet, but in a way that was totally continuous with what, that really revealed the operations that Coltrane was putting her through.
Coltrane,
Mary Martin,
McCoy Tyner, Jimmy Garrison.
So you're speaking about operations.
Roy Haynes.
And I suddenly hear Botox in Pro Tools, and I have this mishearing interesting moment when you said architecture being frozen music, and I heard forensic. What you're doing is some sort of anatomy that delves into sheer chopping, and which I think resonates with the actual doings of sampling music and scratching, which is going from a very analytical and anatomical approach to something that in the end produces this drift into the material.
That's interesting. I'm going to replay that maybe a little bit differently. But the Botox, I think, is relevant in the sense that it's when you have the plastic surgery that's too good, and so therefore it's totally artificial. And so that's what I didn't want to do on this thing, is to sort of do this. I wanted to do it really analytic. I wanted to make it really verifiable. Not that it was exactly... it's not like I was trying to prove either here in the research of the Italian architects what their original intent was, or what exactly they were thinking at that moment. I don't think you can do that. I don't think it's hard enough to know one's own intentions, let alone anyone else's. What you can track is the attentions. So what I could begin to demonstrate is the ways of thinking during the piece. So in fact, it wasn't. I didn't see it as somehow creating either a Frankenstein or chopping it up into pieces that wouldn't come back together. I was really interested in the totality of the piece, and showing the totality was a series of these techniques and operations. And so I wanted to get precise enough so that as you're listening to it, as your listeners are listening to it, it seems really evident that that would be what, if Mary was on stage scatting with John, that that's what she would be doing.
So now it shows recording. So there is an encounter with this work by the Hilliard Ensemble and Christoph Poppen playing the violin. They make a similar experiment with Bach's Partita, this very famous piece for violin solo, and this is based on a claim, a musicological theory.
That's
right?
A musicological theory that Bach had embedded lyrical choral modes within what had been assumed to be a purely instrumental piece. So the experiment for the Hilliard Quartet was to combine or find within the piece these moments, these choral moments, and create this hybrid. And there's lots of resonance over here. Bach's wife, it was a piece that was honoring the death of Bach's wife, Maria. So we have many Marias here. It's how do you solve the problem of Maria? Is the problem for Hammerstein, it's a problem for Bach, it's a problem for culture, and it's a problem for me. And the point is not to solve it, but to keep the hunt for the solution of this ongoing, and so that the listener feels like they're engaged with, they're on the hunt too. So it was fantastic to see that some of the very same operations that I was doing with Coltrane was now being operated on this Bach piece here.
I did get the impression that your piece, listening to the Hilliard Ensemble as we're doing now, there is a melancholic mood about this. There's some sort of tombstone-ness to these couplings and these versions, and the fact that Coltrane is playing this until the day he dies, as if the music itself contains some sort of, as you said, blues gospel. I think it's very interesting that you speak about entanglement and that your work reveals this type of entanglement.
Yeah, the entanglement is really in the object, and that's the point for me about it's really research I'm doing. This is not my gray album. There's no commercial intent here. It's an academic research exercise, although if anyone wants to hire me as a producer or as a consultant, I'm available. But it's really research for me, because what I'm trying to do is to figure out the way in which these particular artists, and it could be a musician, it could be a writer, it could be an architect, it could be a painter for me, are creating dynamic works where the dynamicness is in the object. The object is in the midst of trying to seek out a resolution that's not resolved. And to see the transformations that take place there is what I'm on the hunt for. And so in a certain way, that's why I have to be even more surgical maybe than the Hilliard needs to be. They can sort of elide differences over there, and it's fairly close. Although in another way, they're more scholarly in that particular piece because they're trying to track the whole work. I don't think Coltrane is really operating that way. I don't really think it's a total start to finish with him. He starts the piece outside of the start of the actual song. He does end, as we do with him, very precisely on the ending. But between, I think he's ranging within the universe, but not necessarily it's the whole song that has been stretched out. Although that's another version that I would like to do, where we really try to... And the question of proof or the truth of the analysis... the architectural historian Manfredo Tafuri talks about a verifiable hypothesis. His point is that you have a hypothesis, you need to be able to verify it in the object, or Eisenstein or whatever I'm looking at, but the attentions, and tracking the attentions in the object, the performative attentions, in a way that tries to get closer and closer to not so much the personal intention, but as the modes of the time and the modes of their operations. Now that requires a taking apart, a chopping, the surgery that you talk about, breaking it down in order to see where the transformations take place. The moments of disjunction, this goes back to 16th century music theory, which says that you shouldn't have too much resolution immediately because it becomes overly sweet and it disappoints the listener. That you want to keep prolonging the act of resolution and not allow it to happen too quickly. So that means that dissidence, this is even in the famous book from the 16th century, The Courtier, Castiglione. One of the speakers says that you should make sure that there's moments of dissonance, but really the correct term is imperfect consonance, that you allow the prolongation, and so when finally it gets resolved, it resolves, the pleasure happens in that. And I think that's really important in culture, and that's totally the beauty of the piece. But the point that I was trying to prove is that almost totally he is within the universe of Mary. And so in the companion piece that I did, first dual spell with an A, second dual spell with an E, duet, it's the same, it is the MC track, but when we're within Mary's realm, it's just Mary singing. We don't have Coltrane backing up. When it gets beyond Mary, it's just Coltrane playing. And that follows a bit the duet anticipated. That's why we called the first track that. Is we take the alternatingness that happened at the end of the original Broadway tune with the Mother Abbess. And we now replay that now, where Mary or John alternate with each other. Well, there's several funny things about that. Well, one thing is that you can really see how we're anamorphically stretching and operating.
These are a few of my favorite things. Rain roses, and biscuits. Right up a pet. From a he's got a few of my favorite
But also therefore what the seemingly abstract versions are doing as well. So dancer who says, who's asked about the difference between a character that he enacts in a performance and himself, his own life, and he says, "I don't commute." So I don't commute.
John Coltrane,
Mary Martin,
McCoy Tyner, Jimmy Garrison, Roy Haynes.
Then it's either all scholarship or none of it's scholarship. Meaning the whole point of, to me, the whole point of scholarship is not just to, going back to Tafuri, it's not just to verify in an empirical way some fun facts to know and tell. It's about seeing modes of thought, modes of cultural thought that are in an object. And so in the house that I'm designing in Jakarta now, the same techniques of trying to research what are the modes of cultural operations there that then I will sample and scratch in the house itself, or operate as a performative way in the house itself, to me is the, you know, I utilize the same techniques literally when I do research in the 16th century. Scholarship and design and writing is trying to perform that cultural thinking in a way that engages in forms of meaning and meaning of form to the viewer, to the reader, to the inhabitant.